But I thought I was really close. I thought I was really close.
What led you to believe that?
I thought I had realized something I hadn't realized structurally. And I thought, like, you know, if I realize something structurally that I haven't realized before, then that's got to be the solution. Uh-huh. And no, it doesn't have to be the solution. So we'll go there. Okay, so where we were, there we had, right, the way the sugya is structured is we have a thesis. The thesis is that halakha beats beats kavod. Mm-hmm. We have five counterexamples, and the one, and at the end of the sugya, we know that kavod beats the rabbanans. We know that kavod beats money isurim, and we know that kavod beats passive isurim. At least that's what we think we know. Mm-hmm. Right, that's what all the answers we have given, and so now we point out, but it seems to generate an incoherence because the initial claim was a theological claim, right? Nothing stands against God, and now it's nothing stands against God unless what God says is X, Y, and Z, which is a little bit hard. Right, that's the basic problem we're addressing, is that the end of the sugya does not seem really to be presenting even though all the individual moves have been solved, right? All the individual questions are solved, but the concluding thesis is not coherent.
And so would one of the reasons be why it's not coherent be a presumption of the one of the premises is that kavod is, when we start off the discussion, not from God in some way.
Yeah.
Different, separate.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you say kavod is nothing against God?
Right.
So kavod is separate from God in some way. And you can get around it by refuting that premise, kind of what you were saying a second ago, right? That, God really wants this other thing too, and wants it more than God wants something else.
Right. So we could say that we have reduced the sugya. We started with a theological premise, and in the end, we're just in a technical legal conversation, like any other technical legal conversation, and we've just forgotten about the theology.
So when you say a theological premise,
Theological premise is that, right, that nothing is worthwhile against God, right? So we start, right? You know, so therefore all that we should be spinning out is what does God want of us? And we should not be, you know, introducing these soft ideas like human dignity. Either human dignity can be rooted specifically in law, or it can't be rooted in law. Mm-hmm. Right, now that's a little bit
okay.
Right, that's a little bit challenging because like the whole mechanism of law, as we start at the end, all the mechanism of law is that we expand points. Mm-hmm. All right, that's what the Gemara keeps saying at the end, right? You know, we have this one point. Well, why not treat that one point? You want to treat that point as an exception? Let's not treat it as an exception. Let's treat it as a paradigm. Mm-hmm. And then, right? Then the whole, you know, once you do that, so then it's not easy to distinguish between technical legal claims mm-hmm. and broad claims about soft concepts. Once we allow a technicality to stand for a broad concept. So you can't really distinguish them.
Okay.
So we put out last time over that there's this one wild Rishon at the top, right? The Moshav, right? The Moshav Zakenim, who seems to think that the end of the sugya means that in fact live human dignity overrides everything, and it's only the dignity of the dead that is limited by the sanction that overrides passive things. Mm-hmm. And that was very hard to understand because, so far as we can tell, so far as I can still tell, the end of the sugya, at the end of the sugya, the opening statement about shatnez is still standing. Mm-hmm. And the opening statement of shatnez is honor of the live. And he has explained, so why do you have to take your clothes off? Obviously, because there is, right, because there's some category of law that overrides human dignity. Mm-hmm. So the claim that in the end, as this person says, right, that kod habriot dechayim doche afilu bekuma say, that the honor, live human dignity overrides, you know, even overrides the law even actively, that seems unsustainable. We saw that there might be a position in the Jerusalem Talmud that says that, although we haven't done that as a text inside yet, but maybe we'll do that next time. But we didn't see any way, and I still don't see any way, of reading the Bavli to say that, even though it's clear that in this Rishon that he is that he's quoting the last line of the Bavli, so he must be explaining the Bavli, so that's a mystery. So we also looked at the Rambam. I'm going to look at the Rambam again now, and maybe we'll solve the Rambam today. The Rambam had what seemed to be an anomaly around the same line of the Talmud, which would make us suspect that maybe they're dealing with the same thing in different ways. We may solve it, and the way we solve it may be helpful or may not be helpful for the other Rishon. Then we're going to do Tosfot, which we didn't do last time, and Tosfot is going to introduce a wholly different way of thinking about the sugya. All right, that's the big thing we'll do today, and then we'll start looking at a parallel source and try and see what that parallel source does. And then if we actually get everything done, we're going to go to Rashi and look at how Rashi put, because we kind of went out of order by doing the sugya without Rashi. There is an advantage to that because Rashi, you know, once you've read Rashi, you're prejudiced, and Rashi isn't the only way to read the sugya. On the other hand, usually you can't really read the sugya at all without Rashi, and so maybe that we're just making mistakes because we haven't read Rashi. So we'll see. That's it. My ambition today is to get through Rashi, and then next week we'll do the Yerushalmi. We'll do a Meiri that also does anomalous things to that same section, and maybe by then I'll have figured out how to solve it, or maybe not. Right now, my confidence ratio has dipped, you know, from a high of 95 to somewhere in the teens now. Okay, so here we go. Yeah.
So not being a scholar of Talmud, is it sort of common, uncommon, unheard of to have an unsolvable sugya?
So there are, there are jokes about this in Yeshiva, right, that there are Tosfot that end with Tzarich Iyun, this requires investigation, and yet there's an ex Tosfot, so obviously it must be possible to survive, right, survive questions. There are very famous questions, issues that have not had satisfactory solutions. Are there issues that have no solution? It's very rare for people to throw up their hands and say, I have no solution to this at all, but I'm sure that, it's just not clear that anybody knew about this, right? This commentary just reemerged sort of on the scene recently because it got put on a particular site. So I haven't seen anybody else cite it before. But eventually, you know, over the next 50 years or so, as it becomes, right, people will offer the obvious solutions and they won't work very well, but they'll be famed and they'll still be famous. I think that there are famous problems. And usually there are standard answers to the famous problems, and usually there are reasons the standard answers don't work. I didn't tell my joke about the eighth parak of Yoma last week. Often talk about that. When I was a teenager, I realized there was one transition line in the beginning of the eighth parak of Yoma that simply didn't make any sense at all. And it kept me up at night for a long time. It still does, because like it's like an obvious problem. It should have been noticed by everybody. And I would go ask like various scholars, like, how do you explain this line? They would give me the obvious answer, and I would explain why the obvious answer was wrong. And so I would say, like, I expected a wave of insomnia to be sweeping through the Yeshiva world, but other people seem to be capable of living with that question. And it's been a while since it woke me up. It's still bothersome. It's still bothersome. But you know, if you read, let's say, you know, 19th century works by random people, you'll see that that probably 20 to 30% of all the essays, like rough guess, all address the same famous questions. Uh-huh. Everyone knows what the famous questions are, and they'll talk about it. You know, and this is an essay on the famous question of how X, Y, and Z. But this isn't famous because nobody knew about it, right? It's that. Now that, you know, if I, whoever reads my stuff, presumably, well, after several years of sleepless nights, we'll find some way to write about it, and then there'll be standard answers which are unsatisfactory.
So for you, for this one...
Is somebody trying to get in? Okay, they got in. I got it. It's fine. Yeah.
How much of it is a technical challenge? Right. Keeps you up at night. And, you want to see. And how much of it is... it's a big question.
Depends on the question. This one is a really big question for me, right? The role of human dignity in law is a huge question. So the existence of this position is it would be really important if it were sustainable, and yet I can't figure out a way to sustain it. So it nags at me. Also, it's a sugya I thought I knew so well, and yet right, something shows up that makes no sense at all. How did that happen? So it bothers me personally that I didn't know about it, and it bothers me because it's important. And I generally don't like mistakes. Uh-huh. You know, it's very hard for me when it's an obvious error, it seems more likely to me that it's my fault than somebody else. That really bothers me, because like, people shouldn't make errors like that. Minor figures can make errors like that, but major figures in the tradition shouldn't make errors like that, and so it makes me feel I'm being stupid. because I should be able to solve this. But maybe this one's complicated. You know, what I thought today I had done was reduce it. Like sometimes I talk about Kuhnian. Sometimes, like, you know, you say, okay, this needs a paradigm shift. Now I've solved the paradigm shift. Now I still need to solve, you know, I need to do the experiments to figure out which of these things will work. But I know that eventually somewhere here will be a solution. That's where I thought I was today, but nope. The structural problem is, so far, is still insuperable. Okay, let's take a look at the Rambam. The Rambam says, right, that if you see kilayim shel tara l'chaveiro, if you see deoraita shatnez on your friend, even if he's in the marketplace, you jump at him and you tear his clothing off, even if it's your teacher. Right, we talked about how the Rambam gets to teacher him because of the wine in the Gemara. And now he says, she'en kavod ha-briot doche isur lo ta'ase ha-meforash b'torah, because kavod ha-briot does not push aside a negative commandment that is explicit in the Torah. And we were like, Bali, like, where did he get this explicit from? Yeah, that's right. That's the whole... So it sounds like offhand, our first thing is that it must be in contrast to rabbinic, right? Rabbinic, right? Where rabbinically, the lotasur is just a general statement, so the actual the action is not explicit in the Torah. And structurally, right, that's what it seems like, right? He says, it's not doche lo tzei mefrash b'torah, we skip all the stuff I indented, aval davar shi esirom edivraham, but things that are only rabbinic, harehu nidche mikmei kvod abriyot b'chol makom. Right? So that's, and even though it says lotasur, that's pushed aside, right? So the simple way of understanding Rambam is that Yisur Mefarash B'Torah is just another way of talking about Deraisas as opposed to Derabanans. Okay. But in the parenthesis, in the indented section, the Rambam says, okay, what about Hashavat Avidah? What about returning lost objects? That's the fourth challenge in the Gemara. You don't have to return lost objects if it's against your dignity. So that he says, B'nei Shu Lav Shel Mamon. That looks just like the Gemara, right? That's different. So you don't push aside lo ta'aseh mefarash b'Torah unless it's about money. Okay, fine. But then he says, v'lama nidche b'tumat meit, so why do we allow you to bury a meit mitzvah even when that's otherwise forbidden because of kavod? So he says, ha'ilu parat ha'katuv la'achoto, because the Torah made an explicit statement about the not burying your sister generally. So they learned, Mipuash Willam do, so the rights of the rabbis learned, he does not become tameh for his sister or any other relative, avalma tameh hu lemeit mitzvah. So we know, right, but you do become tameh for a corpse that has no one else to bury it. But the problem is, that's not the right answer. The right answer is, because that's only passive. Right. The right answer in the Gemara says, why don't we learn from that last case? The Gemara says, because that's passive. And the Rambam doesn't mention passivity, right? He ends the Gemara as if the Gemara ended two lines earlier, right? The Gemara said, what about that bright? So the Gemara said, well, that's different because it says the verse. The Gemara said, why don't we generalize the verse? And the answer is because that's passive. And the Rambam leaves out the, why don't we generalize it? Because that's passive. So why does he leave it out? Right, that's a structural. He knows, right? We don't understand. He has the structure because the previous case, right, was Gemara went for the same thing. Maybe lost objects are different because it says a verse. No, why don't we generalize the verse? Oh, because it's about money. So the Rambam said it because it's about money. But here, the Rambam doesn't mention the last line. So that is very puzzling, right? Why does the Rambam not mention passivity as a criteria? Okay, that made me suspicious because the other Rishon I didn't understand said passivity only applies to cases where it's the honor of the dead and not the honor of the living, and here the Rambam leaves it out entirely. A little bit suspicious. Okay, so we're going to find a solution to that, I think, to the Rambam. So that's source number three, which is a Tosfot that I have excerpted, but I think it will give us a clue at least to the Rambam. So Tosfot says the following. On the last line of the Gemara, passivity is, right, Shevel Tasa Shane, passive is different. You can override passive halacha passively. V'im Tamar, and he says, hang on a sec. Nazir v'koin gadol kum asehu diyatame lemeit. So Tosfot points out that the braita we use as the last proof really has three cases in it. There are three kinds of people, maybe more, but three kinds of people who can become tameh to bury a meit mitzvah, even though ordinarily they're not supposed to become tameh. One is a kohen, one is a nazir, and the third is a person going to bring a korban pesach or to circumcise their son or to do both. So Jesus says the passivity answer only works for the last one. It doesn't explain why a kohen gadol can bury a meit mitzvah, even though a kohen is forbidden to become tameh. It doesn't explain why a nazir can bury a meit mitzvah. So what has the Gemara done at the end, Tosfos says?
So why is the third one?
The third one, I am not, by becoming Tameh, right. I'm not bringing a Korban Pesach. Okay. I'm not circumcising my son. Mm-hmm. But Tosfos says, so that only, right, that only answers the third, one of the three cases. Mm-hmm. So the Gemara's answer is insufficient, says Tosfos. What about the first two cases? Why can a Kohen Gadol marry a Bet Mitzvah? Why can a Nazir marry a Bet Mitzvah? So Tosfos says, Elanira, Dimi Nazir Lo Gamrinan, that we don't learn out from the fact that a Nazir can marry a Bet Mitzvah, Dimal Nazir Sheken Yeshno Bish'ela. So that's a structure which says, right, which says that Nazir is different, or you can't learn from it, because it has a factor about it that is not generalizable. And the factor is a Nazir is undoable by undoing, when Nazir is created by a vow, so you can undo the vow. Right? Yeshno b'she'ela means that you can ask an authority to undo your vow. And therefore, Nazir is a weaker prohibition than other kinds of prohibition. So it says, that's why, right, the Gemara never bothers asking why we don't learn from Nazir, because it knows why we don't ask from Nazir, learn from Nazir. Nazir, right, or more specifically, the Gemara knows that we couldn't learn from Nazir to Shatnez. Because Nazir is a prohibition that is created, that is challengeable, or right, and Shatnez isn't. Mm-hmm. So the Gemara never bothered asking that question. And the Gemara, right, and then he says, well, what about Kohen Gadol? Right? V'cheni Kohen, we also never bothered asking the question about a Kohen. Mala Kohen, Shekein Lav Sheino Sheveb Bekol. Because a Kohen is also a unique category, a different category of prohibition, because it only applies to Kohenim. So you can't move from prohibitions that only apply to Kohanim to things that apply to everybody.
Okay.
So Tosfos says, so really, Tosfos says, really that Braita, there are three questions against in the Gemara. You said that Kavod can't beat Halacha, but here I have three cases where Kavod beats Halacha. I have the Kohen, I have the Nazir, and I have the person bringing their Korban Pesach. Mm-hmm. And the Gemara only answers the last one. So Tosfos comes in and says, oh yeah, but the other two was obvious to the Gemara, so he didn't even have to mention why that was so. Mm-hmm. But now it turns out, according, so there are a couple of things. First of all, according to Tosfos, it turns out that the answer, Sheva Alta Seshane, only applies to the third category, which is things that are passive. Sheva Alta Seshane only applies to the cases of Pesach and circumcision. That's not the right answer for the cases of Kohen Gadol and Nazir. Mm-hmm. So now we can go back to the Rambam and say, why didn't the Rambam mention the answer of Sheva Alta Seshane? Because the Rambam isn't talking about the cases of Pesach and circumcision. Mm-hmm. Why isn't he? Because the Rambam said that his starting principle was Kodah Brios doesn't push aside an Isur Lot Aseh. I'm a furash betura, a prohibition that do not do. So now, when it comes to the Korban Pesach and circumcision, it's not a lota ase. Mm-hmm. It's really, right, that's what we call an isura ase. There's a prohibition, there's an obligation to do something, and there's a prohibition to not do it. Mm-hmm. So that's not included in the Rama's category, right? The Rama's category of things that he has to explain. Because he just said, she'en kvod abriot docha isur lota ase. It only, right, he said, my starting proposition is that it doesn't push aside don't do's. And so he never asked, right, if that's your starting proposition, not that it doesn't push aside anything in Torah, but only that it doesn't push aside don'ts, so then you don't have to explain Pesach, because Pesach is a do. You don't have to explain circumcision, because circumcision is a do. So he's already left out all the cases that are passive. And that's why the Rambam leaves, right, only doesn't mention the answer, because the Rambam only mentions the answer that relates to the questions that the Gemara doesn't ask. The question the Gemara doesn't ask is, what about Kohen Gadol? What about Nazir? Mm-hmm. And that the Rama, right? So the Rama doesn't have to mention the Shevel Tasashani, because that's the answer to the wrong question. Now the interesting thing is, though, that
it's inferring a lot from
silence
being written. Yeah.
Yeah, but structurally it works.
But okay.
Now the question is, however, though, why doesn't the Rambam mention one of Tosfos's answers then? Right, Tosfos says there are cases that are not addressed by the question of Shevel Tasashani, and now, okay, so the Rambam doesn't mention Shevel Tasashani because he's talking about the other cases, but Tosfos thinks that those questions also have to have answers, and he gives you answers. right? That it's different because it's challengeable. It's different because it's not a universal prohibition. So why doesn't the Rambam feel it necessary to provide those answers? I understand why he left out the answer that is in the Gemara, but I don't understand why he left out the answers that aren't in the Gemara and just left it as it's just a verse. We should ask, it's just a verse, okay, so why don't we generalize it? So that I don't have an answer for yet. I may have an answer at the end. But for now, I just leave it like, okay, so I scratched a little bit of the itch in the Rambam. I solved that why he left the Gemara out, but I haven't solved why he didn't feel it necessary to put something in. Now, I have pointed out, so I guess this is my usual big word on the sugya, is that what Tosfot tells you is that there are many more answers than the Gemara gives to explain why kavod pushes aside halacha. Mm-hmm. Right. So the question then is, what are you supposed to do when confronted by a new case? So it could be when I'm confronted, right? You know, if I just read the sugya, I would think, okay, what I'm supposed to do when I confront a new case is I look, is it money? Okay, if it's not right, if it's not money, then I say, okay, is it passive? Okay, and then that's the answer. Now, Tosfos tells me no. I need to look, is it money? Is it right? Is it passive? Is it a challengeable law? Is it a law that applies to everybody? Now, that means that Tosfos has no evidence at all for his claim that those two, right? He's just reasoning backwards. Since the Gemara doesn't bother asking the question, it must assume that those other two categories are also exempt. So now those two categories are, right, since he has no explicit statement, so it sounds like what he's saying is that any category that is not right, any category that a halakha can be fit into can be made an exception. So now, confronted by a new case, I don't just have to look for the cases mentioned in categories mentioned in Tosfot. I have to demonstrate that the law I'm trying to override doesn't fit into any of the categories that make it different than Shatnez. Now, my argument is that a really good lamdan should be for any given law should be able to find a way in which it's different than Shatnez. Mm-hmm. Right, that's your job to think of differences, and if that's the case, so I talk about reading the sugya as a vector as opposed to as a flat, meaning that what the sugya teaches you is that the proper response to a new case is not to say, oh, look, halakha beats kavod, you can't do anything. The proper answer is to explain why this case is different, mm-hmm. while still leaving the shatnez case standing because we have a principle after all. And the principle is that God's will trumps everything. It's just that your job, whatever it seems like God's will is trumping dignity, is to find a way in which God doesn't really want that. Right, so I read this right. So I read the sugya as right that it just teaches you a direction. The proper thing that when it's clear to you that kavod should beat halacha, morally, so your job is to find a way in which you can say that and nonetheless say that shatnez is different. Because if you just said already, that's why the risha that I can't explain is important, because he thinks you don't even need that. You can just say it overrides. But I think that the way I read the sugya, which I think is following from Tosfot, is that the sugya gives you a direction, right? Since the principle is no longer coherent at the end of it, so the only way to sustain the principle as a coherent thing is that it's a symbolic thing. There's one case that is supposed to stand for the proposition, right? Which is that God can ask you to give up your dignity, but in reality, you're always supposed to find a way that dignity that dignity wins. But you have to do that. You have to justify that while maintaining the principle.
So if someone was wearing shatnez in the market,
yeah, then you want to take the clothes off. Assuming that you know for certain it's shatnez, assuming that shatnez d'oraisa, not the rabbanan, as we'll see, assuming that it's not in a Beit Midrash where they have something where we're distracted from Torah learning. Assuming that they're male. There are all sorts of ways, right? Assuming that they did it deliberately, there are all sorts of ways in which, even in the shatnez case, I could find, if that's my goal, right? Really, the only way I could have it out is if somebody deliberately goes out into the marketplace and says, ha, I am wearing shatnez on purpose, and tell you, right? So, probably, if I thought that was the right way to paskin, probably I could end up making sure that I would never have to paskin that way unless somebody deliberately wanted me to. Which somebody might, just to establish the principle. If you want an analogy, by the way.
Any difference, yeah. If there's never a case,
Yeah.
Where kavod is trumped by halakha.
Yeah.
Of what difference does it make whether there is this stated impossible possibility?
Right. So there's a couple of ways to answer that. Uh-huh. One is that it's not true that kavod never beats halakha, because you need to establish kavod never loses halakha. You need to establish a threshold of kavod.
Uh-huh. So you can say a threat.
No, you need to establish a threshold. It is that not all kavod beats all halakha. Right? That's what the sugya is, an abstraction, as we said. But in real life, right, because I will suffer a minor indignity doesn't mean I can violate Shabbos. Mm-hmm. So in order to make those decisions properly, you need to you need to have the principle established that really it's not that law is meaningless and kavod is all that matters. There are conflicting values, and we're trying to do it seriously. So unless you have that principle in your mind, if you just walk in saying, "Oh no, right, halakha kavod always wins," so then you'll end up, which is there's many of the most controversial cases nowadays. Many controversial is when people have difficulty with halakha in one way or another, so they resort to saying, "Oh yes, but it's kavod habriyot." And people's human dignity is a highly mutable. Yeah, human dignity is a highly mutable category. It's very dependent on so you need to have a fixed point that says no. You really need to justify it without saying.
This isn't addressing that.
Yeah.
I don't think it. I feel like this would be just the scale issue. We've got a kavod meter.
No, I don't think the sugya is. I think the sugya is not addressing it.
Yeah.
And that would leave you the law very vulnerable to being overridden left and right. Mm-hmm. So that's why we establish no, right? You actually really the theological principle is that not so much, right? So you have to show that God really wants this kavod, right? I think it helps you establish a threshold that right. Whereas if you just said the outcome was the kavod beats halacha, who would need a threshold?
It feels a little circular because unless you have a measuring stick, threshold. One could say, okay, I'm allowed to that avoiding suffering, stopping suffering, trumps halakha, but a paper cut doesn't count as suffering.
So the question is, right? I think the more seriously you take halakha, the less likely you are to use paper cuts to override it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a...
Here's a relative measure question. Is that because the paper cut loses its pain, or because you determine that you should raise your threshold of pain?
I think you determine that you should raise your threshold of pain because this is something worth suffering for.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't think it's worth suffering for, then you're right, then your threshold of pain will, same way as anything in life, right? That depending on whether it's worth, you'll come in for things if you think it's worth coming in for them, even though you feel a little bit under the weather. But if you don't feel it's worth coming in, if you didn't want to go in anyway, so then you'll start taking sick days, I imagine. I, of course, wouldn't know anything about this. I never took sick days. But got never very unhappy. I'd like to think. So I'll give you a wild analogy. So we have the position of Rabbi Akiva that says that we never carry out the death penalty halachically. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon say that. So if you're a Hasidic figure, you have to figure out, so how do they carry it out in the desert? Mm-hmm. Right, there is a person who's executed for killing Shabbos, right, for violating Shabbos. So the answer must be that he did it on purpose. But you have to do halachically, right? You have to say, I'm doing it right. The witnesses have to warn you and say, you're violating this, and it's a capital crime, because he didn't want people to take Shabbos unseriously. So he sacrificed himself. Mm-hmm. So it's the only time it's ever going to happen. Uh-huh. But it's there, right? So that's, that's in that interpretation, is right. He did it, right? It happened once, because you have to treat Shabbos as something that is potentially a capital crime. Mm-hmm. And then having established that, then the job of everybody thereafter, whenever it happens, is to make sure you don't execute anybody.
Almost, it's like an as-if argument, right? You should behave
as if
this rule had real-life practical effect.
Yes.
But it relies on a little sleight of mind, I guess, right? Because you got this contradiction of to motivate yourself to get people to behave in the right way, they have to sort of consciously believe something that consciously believe something might happen and simultaneously believe that will never happen.
Yeah, so that's a complicated thing. I'll give you an even more sophisticated or complicated version about this case. Maybe the standard for Code of Brio, right, if you're a POSIG addressing it, changes depending on how seriously people take it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the less committed people are to the notion that halakha is allowed to override human dignity, the less you are allowed to rule that it does. And the more people... It could be that in a society,
okay,
right, where the default is, of course, God can, right, halakha can require things that override human dignity, so then you never have to paskin that it does. Mm-hmm. But in a society where people think, like, what right would God have to take, right, to demand anything? How could there be any other value that requires a loss of human dignity, so then you wouldn't be allowed to do that. Because what you're trying to do is maintain an equilibrium, exactly that, where people treat it as really serious, and they treat Code of Brio as more serious, as opposed to... Okay, I should probably just cut it short then, and we'll... pick it up next week. Okay, I'll just interrupt then.